When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. We love guitars.
And welcome to another podcast. It's LiesOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. And with us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Brother, here's kind of a montage of Democrats celebrating Tuesday night.
When we launched this campaign, conventional wisdom dictated that this race was unwinnable.
We voted and we won and we did all of this together.
Today is a milestone, but it is really a beginning.
It will hear my voice. It will hear all of our voices.
We're taking our voice to Washington.
Here in Minnesota, we don't only welcome immigrants, we send them to Washington.
Welcome. How about that? Kind of a familiar pattern in that tape. A lot of women, a lot of diversity.
That is correct. And really stunningly healthy component of our politics. You know, you can see so many things in our politics.
You speak up just a little, John.
Sure. As I said, a really healthy component of our politics. We see a lot of things in our politics that make us want to run away, right? Want to be incredibly turned off and discouraged. But here we see the promise of America, right? This notion that our elections ought to empower people who look like the whole of America, that ought to make a real representative democracy. And, you know, I have to tell you that in many parts of this country, the people who you're celebrating there had to really fight not merely against Republicans, but sometimes against Democrats to get to the place where they're at. And so this is a year where a lot of people political norms and political expectations and broke through. And with all the things that you can celebrate about Tuesday night and the things you can mourn or be frustrated with, it seems to me that that is the thing or the development that we ought to highlight and that we ought to be most excited about. The fact that a Somali American who was a refugee is going to Congress from Minneapolis. The fact that a Palestinian American is going to Congress from Detroit, the fact that the child of folks from Puerto Rico, part of America, but often, you know, genuinely disenfranchised in so much of our politics, is going to Congress from New York. And the interesting thing is, they're all young women. And that's a pretty good thing for America.
Chris Matthews has been talking about how some of this is a reaction directly to the Access Hollywood tape that inspired a lot of people to run.
I think it did. We know this from interviewing people, right? Folks have said exactly that they, you know, looked at the circumstance, and it may have been the Access Hollywood tape, but I think also things like Donald Trump immediately moving on a Muslim ban. Things like Donald Trump's assaults on immigrants and refugees and basically anybody who doesn't fall into his very narrow category of who he approves of. I think that caused a lot of people to think that this was a time to step up. And the interesting thing about it is that when they made that decision, they were often told, no, this is a really tense, a really difficult time. So we have to do things cautiously, right? You have to kind of, go with the safest bet to challenge Trump. And what a lot of these people said was, no, going with the safest bet, going in a cautious way, doesn't work. that it hasn't worked. It's often failed. And so they stepped up.
I think some of that depends.
Do it more boldly.
I think it depends on the state. I'm not sure a Somali refugee would be elected statewide in West Virginia. But I get your point.
Well, I mean, look, I understand how we may see we may see barriers, right? And I respect that. But I will note that if I had said, a few years ago that we were going to have an election where we're going to be sending, the first one election, same election, we're sending the first Native American women to Congress, we're sending first Muslim women to Congress, we are sending the highest number of women to Congress, that we are diversifying our Congress on the basis of gender, religion, sexuality, race, ethnicity, and even class. And this is a really interesting thing. Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, the new congresswoman from the Bronx and Queens, I don't know if you saw the interview with her the other day, where she said she hasn't been able to rent an apartment yet in Washington because she saved only a certain amount of money from when she was working in the bar before she ran for Congress. And so she's got to, count her pennies. And until she gets her congressional salary, until she's actually got her job, it's hard for her economically to rent a place in Washington. That's a real breakthrough as regards who we have in Congress.
This is kind of a cute moment that went overlooked because it was early into the morning. But Jackie Rosen, who got elected to the United States Senate, some didn't think she was running a very good campaign, but she actually prevailed with relative ease. She won the Reno-Carson City market, which, of course, was Heller's strength. Here's what she said on election night.
But I have to tell you, I'm a little sentimental tonight because a lot of times you don't get to see bookends in your life. And 40 years ago, I was a young college student working my way through school. And I was a member of 226. But that's not the best part of the story. I was working right down the hall here at Caesar's Palace as a cocktail waitress to pay my tuition. I put my tips in those envelopes, and it paid for my next year of college. And I know it took a while, but 40 years later, I'm back, and here I am.
That was wonderful.
I thought that was about as good as you get, right?
Right.
That's because here you're celebrating your, own accomplishment, which is absolutely appropriate. Somebody should in the victory speech. But she's also connecting it to trade unionism.
Right.
To being a member of a labor union. And I wish more elected officials would do that.
Yeah.
I do. I will say, in our state of Wisconsin, I did hear Mandela Barnes at many stops along the way, and particularly I saw him at a UAW hall on the Sunday before the election, making a big point about how much he liked being in a union hall and talking about growing up around unions. And so credit to him as
and
well.
And he comes from good stock. He comes from two union members.
That's right.
Right. Connor Lamb did a nice job saluting unions again the other night. He really is very open about his support of unions.
And, by the way, I think if more candidates did that, right, it would have, it's a very small thing in a way, but it would, I think, have a very good influence on our politics and even our governance, because it's a way of saying, look, unions really are a part of all this. And I think too often, especially when we have more elite politicians getting elected from both parties, there's a tendency to just forget, to see unions only as some kind of special interest or something like that.
All right, so we have a blue wave that's still waving as we speak on this Friday morning. A lot going on. Now let's play some things that are a little less edifying. The President of the United States at a press conference in the White House the day after the election.
Carlos Cubella, Mike Kaufman, Too bad, Mike. Mia Love. Mia Love gave me no love. And she lost. Too bad. Sorry about that, Mia. And Barbara Comstock was another one. Peter Roskam didn't want the embrace. Eric Paulson didn't want the embrace. Those are some of the people that, you know, decided for their own reason not to embrace whether it's me or what we stand for. But what we stand for meant a lot to most people.
Really, I'm looking at the numbers. He says most people, that really is not the case.
Well, certainly not most people, as we know, because the people he's mentioning, by the way, most people in their districts vote for somebody else, right? And one of the reasons that people in those districts voted for somebody else was because of a discomfort with Donald Trump. And I give Carlos Covella down in Florida credit because he didn't just turn the other cheek or worry about what he's going to do next. He pushed back against the president, and he noted that in his district, he ran dramatically better than the candidates who were up the ballot who aligned themselves with the president. So, you know, just demonstrably, the president is wrong in what he's saying. I mean, genuinely wrong. And it's notable, too, I thought that the reference to Mia Love there was strikingly dismissive. And I think...
Huh. Gee, how could... what's the common denominator there?
No, that's... you know, it's interesting that a number of the people he picked out to criticize are the people that the Republican Party has held up and said, look, we are a more diverse party, right? Mia Love and Covello down in Florida. These are people who did attempt to realize the founding promise of the Republican Party as something more than you know, just this narrow grouping. And here he is when they get defeated, instead of saying, you know, I'm sorry they lost, sorry that maybe I was a part of the reason why they lost, he criticizes them and attacks them. And I would just suggest to you that in those remarks, that short set of remarks there, the president significantly narrowed the appeal of a Republican Party that already lost an awful lot of ground.
Well, and that he sounded like a creepy mobster from Queens. That there's always that too.
Well, there you go.
Here he went. He kept going on this.
You had some that decided to let's stay away. They did very poorly. Carlos Cubella, Mike Kaufman. Too bad, Mike. Barbara Comstock was another one. I mean, I think she could have won that race, but she didn't want to have any embrace. For that, I don't blame her. But she lost, substantially lost. Peter Roskam didn't want the embrace. Eric Paulson didn't want the embrace.
Yeah, if Barbara Comstock had just embraced Donald Trump, she would have won that district.
I promise you, if that had happened, I think, A, she would have lost by more. I mean, if you know that district, that's a pretty good prediction. B, I think if Trump had come into Virginia in some sort of big way for Barbara Comstock, I think it might have helped several other Democrats in other districts. You know, I mean, it's an interesting thing with Donald Trump. I think it is fair to say that there are a few places around the country where him coming in some of these Senate races, might, and I'm going to really emphasize that word might, not definitely was, but might have been helpful, right? But I will give you an example of the guy I will argue he most wanted to get rid of, the guy who he really, really seemed to have the deepest personal animus toward, and went in against, I think, if I'm counting right, 4 times, which is relatively unprecedented in presidential visits, and that's John Tester in Montana, in a state that voted overwhelmingly for Trump, in a state that is, you know, certainly a place where Trump does have supporters, does have appeal. John Tester won. And I noted that Trump didn't Trump didn't go down the list and mention the people like John Tester's opponent, Rosendale, or Leah Vukmir in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. who he aggressively campaigned for, and they lost.
How many times did he go to West Virginia to campaign against Joe Manchin?
Yeah, for a particularly unappealing challenger to Manchin, by the way. So, I mean, it's an interesting sort of blind spot that the president has in this discussion. The people who didn't invite him, well, they lost because they didn't invite him.
The embrace.
The people he went to campaign for who lost, well, what happened there?
We'll talk more. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at sliceoffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
Welcome back to SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steel Workers, also Madison Computer Works. All right, let's talk a little bit about where we're headed here. I tell you, the country never has a dull moment. Last night, I'm talking to my good friend Casey Hoff, criminal defense attorney and writer for Gannett Newspapers. I'm talking to him, and he's in Sheboygan, and he's driving, and he goes, "Oh my God, Sly, there's a rally to protect Mueller in downtown Sheboygan."
Oh yeah,
this was happening all over the country last night.
That was happening.
And by the way, Tony Evers won Sheboygan.
Yeah.
But Sheboygan. People are taking to the streets. Now, here's Donald Trump the day after the election talking about the Democrats.
That when the Democrats take over the chairmanship of all these important committees, you're going to get hit with a blizzard of subpoenas on everything from the Russian investigation to your cell phone use to your tax returns.
Ready? Then you're going to, if that happens, then we're going to do the same thing and government comes to a halt and I would blame them. If they do that, then it's just all it is a warlike posture.
Not even a thinly veiled war.
Okay, so here we are. He fires Jeff Sessions the day after the election. And now, Kellyanne Conway's husband, who's a constitutional scholar, says this installing Matthew Whitaker is not even constitutionally appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And legitimate debate. And certainly something that the new House of Representatives, which will apply the constitutional premise that committees must have oversight, or have, in fact, oversight duties, and that they also have, because of separated powers, a duty to check and balance perceived and real wrongdoing, will have to address this. And that's a basic premise of the American experiment. But one that Donald Trump rejects, and I think it's very important at moments like this to pause and recognize where we get absolute clarity on something. And in that statement, Donald Trump clarified, without question, no debate, and frankly, I think we've both said it before, so it was something that we certainly sensed, but he's clarified it without debate. He's worse than Nixon. Because as bad as Richard Nixon was, literally in the depths of Watergate, you know, and the inquiries they were heading toward impeachment resolutions in the House, Nixon still tried actually very hard to, you know, keep the wheels of government running. I mean, he was talking to people about legislation, about policies, about initiatives. During Watergate, you were seeing the dialing down, too slow in my view, of the Vietnam War. And so this notion that Trump would say, well, if you basically follow the Constitution, if you apply checks and balances to me in any way, if you apply oversight to me in any way, then we're at war. That is worse than Nixon.
It seems like he's at war with everyone. Let me play a couple of clips here.
Are you worried?
That's enough. That's enough.
Mr. President,
enough.
I was going to ask one of the other folks.
That's enough.
Pardon me, ma'am. I'll
tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person.
In Jim's defense, I've traveled with him and watched him. He's a diligent reporter who busts.
Well, I'm not a big fan of yours either. When you report fake news, when you report fake news, which CNN does a lot, you are the enemy of the people.
You called yourself a nationalist. Some people saw that as emboldening white nationalists. Now people are also saying
that that's such a racist
there
question.
Are some people.
One more clip.
How do you see your role as a moral leader? Mr. President, just how do you see your role as a moral leader?
Go ahead. There's so many people, I'm sorry.
As a moral leader, though.
I think I am a great moral leader, and I love our country.
Now, there you go. Quite a moment.
I mean, it's quite astounding when you think about it, right? Because he's saying to people's face now, you are an enemy of the people. Do you think that might possibly be dangerous in any way?
Well, after everything we've had happen.
Yeah, I know. It's just, look, I think you, like I am, a pretty passionate defender of freedom of speech, right? The right of people to say what they think, even if what they think is incredibly wrong. But a president of the United States is a unique figure. And, here we just had 8 years of Barack Obama, who, if anything, was sometimes criticized for being too cautious, too gracious, too gentle in his responses to things. And yet, I think we know why Obama did that. It was because he had a sense of what a president should be, how a president should act. You can despise the policies of the Bushes, but certainly they did that, I think, very frequently, and in fact, and sometimes in very important ways. Here, this president seems to have no respect for that the office itself. And if I could just extend it in one way, I mean, here we're seeing these attacks on the press, and people in the press, to some extent, expect to have a combative relationship with the president. What they don't expect is for the president and his staff to smear them, to literally deny them passes as extended from this exchange. But there's another element of what the president's been doing in the last 48 hours, and that is from the office of the presidency, with this incredible bully pulpit, but also with all of the trappings of the office, all the regard for the role that the president plays, he has been attacking the recount process in the state of Florida.
Hmm.
And when the president, calling, Jim Acosta stuff, saying these things, that's pretty bad. But when the president of the United States is literally saying, from the White House, presumably, via Twitter, via other statements, that something really bad's going on in Florida, that, this is, talk about frauds and wrongdoing and all this, it's like, they're doing a basic process of American democracy, the counting the votes. And when a president undermines, discards, disrespects that, to my mind, that's a point where we ought to pause and say, hold it. This is the president of the United States inviting disregard for basic democratic processes.
All right, let's get to our state election. This is Tony Evers at his victory speech at the Orpheum Theater in Madison Tuesday night.
Focused on solving problems, not picking political fights. I will never make promises I cannot keep, and I will always work for you. It's time for a change, folks. And it is a change that we have delivered. And now that the race is behind us, I look forward to moving forward together. Wisconsin tonight, we do so with grace and humility and a lot of happiness, knowing we cannot fix all our problems with any single person or any election vote. The real work starts tomorrow. And as I said throughout this campaign, it's time for a change. The voters of Wisconsin spoke, and they agree a change is coming, Wisconsin. God bless you. Thank you all.
And I guarantee you, while he was giving that speech, Robin Voss was scheming to think how he could limit the damage to his power hold on the state of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a very telling thing. And so let's first pause and respect that Tony Evers upon his election, middle of the night, right, didn't gloat, didn't kind of play any of the games that we sometimes associate with politics. He gave a really incredibly unifying and dignified speech to people who, in too many cases, been up 24 hours. It was a striking reminder that Wisconsin has elected a very dignified and very focused leader. And I will tell you that Mandela Barnes, who was at his side and spoke before him, similarly dignified, similarly focused, a great energy, a delight in having been elected. It made you feel great about the electoral process, if you will. And then to have Robin Voss, the leader of the state assembly, whose power extends, we should point out, from gerrymandering, right, which undermines efforts to get a full sense of the small d democratic will of the people, looking at the reality that for the first time since 1982, I believe, Democrats had won a U.S. Senate seat and all five constitutional offices that were on the ballot, a pretty good signal that people wanted a change and wanted to trust some different folks. The elections were close, there's no doubt of that. But remember that Scott Walker's elections weren't landslides. And Robin Voss's reaction to this is, oh, well, we now have to move to disempower this new governor. We have to look for ways to undermine Tony Evers' ability to govern. And that's a shocking response, and one that you would not expect in a democracy. And Robin Voss, I just think, A, he should be ashamed, right? If he had problems with gubernatorial power, then why did he conspire with Scott Walker to extend gubernatorial power for the last 8 years?
I'm thinking he doesn't have de Tocqueville on his desk. What do you think?
I don't think so. And I think here's the interesting thing. You've talked to Tony Evers. I've talked to Tony Evers. If there was ever anyone elected governor of Wisconsin who might actually work with the legislature in efforts to democratize, open up the process, and perhaps in some ways to change the responsibilities, the duties of the governor's office, to perhaps re-empower the state treasurer's office, to perhaps re-empower the agencies to, you know, lead and speak. I mean, Evers actually talked about that on the campaign trail. So Voss could have said, you know, look, I look forward to working with this new governor in January to examine, you know, all sorts of issues about how we organize state government. I think that Tony Evers would have said, yeah, let's sit down and talk. Instead, Robin Voss said, no, in some sort of emergency situation, we're going to try and take powers away from the guy that the people just elected.
They appear to be backing off some of that now.
They should.
We'll see. They got a very negative reaction. Here is another clip from the other victor statewide. This would be Josh Call.
I will also work with Tony Evers to withdraw from the lawsuit that is seeking to invalidate the Affordable Care Act.
Well, that has a nice sound to it, doesn't it?
It sure does, you know, and Tony Evers talked about that as well. Look, one of the things that we need to understand, and I think certain listeners to this podcast do understand, is that in this era, attorneys general in states across this country have emerged as incredibly significant figures in our governance. And it is often attorneys general, as much as, in some cases to a greater extent than governors, who are leading on defining policies. Not you know, legislatures shape the policies and governors implement, but attorneys general have a real role in, you know, making sure that they operate within the boundaries of law, and frankly, making sure that the states can assert themselves with regard to the federal government. These are important jobs. Under Brad Schimmel, we had an attorney general who was really interested in printing up coins with his picture on them or with his image on them. and frankly, who more often than not seem to serve as a partisan extension of the governor's office, thus, you know, even extending the powers of the governor more. And what you're going to get with Josh Call, which I think the reason that he won this very tight, very difficult election, is a real shift not toward a quote-unquote Democratic attorney general. He is a Democrat. There's no question of that. But toward a dramatically more independent attorney general's office. And I would not be surprised if there are points with Josh Call where, like his mother, Peg Lautenschlager, when she was attorney general, he might disagree with Democrats. I think he's one of these remarkable folks who went into the law because he loves it and puts the rule of law ahead of partisanship. And that's a very significant change in that office.
It is with great regret that we didn't have some people with us watching that election party, at least here on Earth, whether it be former Attorney General Peg Lautenschlager, whose son was elected, former AFSCME Executive Director Marty Beal, and then, of course, former President of the AFL-CIO Phil Neuenfeld, who died just a couple days before the election.
Yeah, it was especially hard to lose Phil. I'd seen him just a few weeks ago, and, you know, he was the steady hand through the uprising, fight over right to work, the aftermath. He brought great energy and generosity of spirit to that struggle. And I can tell you, having talked to him not that long ago, how profoundly excited he was about the rise of Mandela Barnes, someone who, you know, he had worked with and aligned with on issues over the years in Milwaukee. And I was really sorry that Phil couldn't have been there on early Wednesday morning. I think he would have been celebrating with, you know, all the sense that everybody else had, but also with his brilliant and deep sense of what this means for organized labor in Wisconsin.
After I posted his passing on Facebook, I got the nicest message from former Commerce Director in the Thompson administration, Bill McCoshin, who'd worked with Phil on a number of boards, and Phil had been automatically appointed to a couple positions and oversight, talking about what a remarkably kind, decent, intelligent person he was.
But if people who don't know Phil, and some listeners may not, he was a big guy, very tall, very, you know, He was a presence in any room he walked into, and yet he was gentle, and incredibly thoughtful, careful person. He really did think about what he said. He thought about how to build alliances, build coalitions, and it's interesting that it was Bill McCoshin who sent you a message there, because Billy McCoshin was obviously part of the Thompson era. And the interesting thing about the Thompson era in Wisconsin, which can almost be forgotten, or has been by many people, is that Tommy Thompson and Bill McCoshin, they were not fans of organized labor. They were not aligned with organized labor. They often, you know, would go up against it. Labor tended to back their opponents the whole bit. And yet, they accepted the rules of the game. They accepted that they had to negotiate. They had to respect collective bargaining rights. They had to respect the people that they came up against, and they got to know those people, because in that respect for the process, they came to recognize that the folks that Scott Walker would demonize as, you know, I don't know, whatever term he used for labor leaders, but it was always like this very critical terms as regards labor leaders. What I think that Tommy Thompson and Billy McCoshin understood was that many of these labor leaders are working class intellectuals, who really smart people who are really committed to finding solutions and making things work. And that was certainly Phil.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
You know, we work hard every day. In mills and mines, hospitals and schools, in office buildings, pharmacies and shipyards, factories and forests, in squad cars, ambulances and taxicabs. We do all kinds of jobs in Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, and all across the United States and Canada. We build the things that build our country. We do things that keep our country going, support our families and our communities. We have the courage to stand up even when no one else does. We have the strength to fight for what's right, for our families and for yours. We're your friends, your neighbors, your sisters and brothers. We're more than 1 million members strong. We stand in solidarity with workers in every continent on the globe. We're the United Steelworkers Union, and every day we fight for you. Please join our fight. Visit usw.org or like us at facebook.com/steelworkers.